My name is Andrew Hemingway. I'm chairing this session. We're here to launch Jacob Zuma's book, Communist International and U.S. Communism, 1919 to 1929. We have two respondents to Jacob's book, Mike Goldfield, who is professor of political science at Wayne State University, but before his academic career was a labor agitator. His books include The Color of Politics, Race and the Mainspring of American Politics, The Decline of Organized Labor in the United States, and an edited volume with Devdas Banerjee, Labor, Globalization, and the State. Our other respondent is Brian Palmer, who is Professor of Canadian Studies at Trent University. Brian is the author of 12 books and the editor of the journal Labor for the Travail. He's written extensively on the work of E.P. Thompson, on the history of labor in Canada. He's written an award-winning biography of James P. Cannon, and he has a book just out on the Teamsters strike of 1934. Jacob was his doctorate at the University of London. He currently teaches at New Jersey City University, and he's a research associate of the Promethean Research Library. Mike will speak first. There will be two respondents, and then Jacob will respond in turn. Okay, Mike.
Okay, if I sit down, Stacey? Okay. So I've given a couple talks, including at the HM Conference of London, extolling the virtues of Jacob's book, so I'm not going to do that again. But let me just let me just in terms of an overview and a couple one-liners. So CP in the 1920s is largely ignored by most scholars, with the exception of Theodore Draper's book, who gets a lot of important, who's a careful scholar, but gets a lot of things wrong. And so Jacob's book on the 20s is really, I think, the key outline to understanding this period. And in terms of the left, it seems to me when people break with the Comintern position basically defines their politics. So the Social Democrats abandoned, I mean, if they were ever, even the ones who supported it within the first year when the first people get executed, they're gone. The anarchists after Kronstadt by 1919-1920s denounced the Comintern, with the exception of particularly syndicalists and people like the Wobblies, many of whom actually came over and joined the CP at different periods. There are people who think the Comintern ended with the death of Lenin. Classical Trotsky's position is the Sixth Congress, 1928. And then you can go on with people who break in 35, 37, even to people who leave the CP and after Khrushchev's speech, etc. So this period of the 20s, which has been ignored, and Jacob's book is really the overview that one has to look at in this period. So what I want to talk about is what I see is complications, particularly in the United States, of the third period. Jacob describes both the positive things, the influence of the Comintern in the early 1920s on getting the CP's proper orientation from their breaking of their sectarianism, their underground period, and particularly also the continuous flagellation from the Comintern on the what was called the Negro question, but in other words, how to fit the question of the oppression of African Americans into overall revolutionary strategy. So, and then Jacob's book describes the process of Stalinization, which seems to me is often characterized in much of the Trotsky's discussion as being the end of anything important from the, or positive from the CP. So I think Trotsky's characterization of what happened to the American Party is that on the one hand, it recruited all the best elements of American radicalism, and therefore was an authentic expression of American radicalism, the best elements from the trade union, the Socialist Party, the Black Movement, the IWW, and at the same time they also functioned in Trotsky's apt expression as the border guards for the Soviet Union and Soviet foreign policy. That the third period, beginning supposedly in 1928, the revolutionary period, when all the other groups in the middle were aligned with fascism and the world revolution was about to take place, that in many countries the sectarianism led to total disaster, the worst case being Germany, where the CP was unable and unwilling to mobilize against fascism. Ernst Thälmann, the head of the Communist Party before, a couple months before Hitler took over, said, "After Hitler, us." Complete misreading of what was going on. That even in the U.S., the Stalinization, the sectarianism led to loss of certain opportunities between the 1928 and 1923 period, and the complete control by the Comintern led much of the resources that the CP had during the Popular Front period and the support for Roosevelt to lose much of the political impetus that they might have gained. There's a question of World War II. But what the CP did, some of the things the CP did come partly from the dynamism, but also the contradictions of the third period. So they start the third period with 10 or 12,000 cadre. They triple the number during that period. They led massive interracial, in most places, unemployed struggles in major cities around the country and in virtually every industrial area of the country. They engaged in major struggles against white supremacy, mobilizing large numbers of whites as well as blacks, not only in industrial areas in the north, including New York, which at one time was industrial before any of us remember, Detroit, Chicago, but also in southern cities, Birmingham, Atlanta, Memphis, Louisville, and a variety of other places. They also organized black sharecroppers in several states in the South, most important being Alabama and what turned out to be tragedy. And they had cadre throughout the whole 20s, as Cannon talks about in detail, in steel, auto, electrical, longshore, and in virtually every industry in the country, people who work quietly and secretly and in auto throughout the whole 20s, and who were prepared, therefore, when the labor upsurge took place in the 1930s. In particular, and I'm going to talk at the end about their position on the Black Belt and the Black question, their impetus after the Sixth Congress was totally aggressive and uncompromising in terms of dealing with the question of African-American equality. In 1929, they led over a month period a textile strike in Gastonia, North Carolina, which was an all-white textile plant of several thousand people. The top demand they had was full equality for African Americans. They sent in black organizers as part of their organizing group. And they did the same thing in Harlan County in 1931. Theodore Draper has an article where he describes that the United Mine Workers pulled out within a couple days because so many people were getting killed and they were afraid to be in the area. The CP stayed there, and in the middle of this, They told the workers, 90% of whom were white, who refused to eat in an interracial union cafeteria, that the struggle couldn't go on until the union facilities were integrated. And as Draper documents, they spent 10 hours arguing with people while people being killed all over, saying that they would not, could not proceed. And they finally either convinced or wore down the main opponents. They engage in Scottsboro, which people know about. And even during the third period, while they were sectarian, they had alliances with African American churches, including Adam Clayton Powell's church in Harlem over Scottsboro. So in some sense, their sectarianism was more complicated. In Birmingham, they led unemployed struggles. The as Robin Kelly documents in his book Hammer and Hoe about black communists in Alabama, at one demonstration led by a white working class woman in Birmingham with 7,000 people, the police chief says, "Do you believe in interracial marriage?" And she says, "Why not?" as they hauled her off. So as opposed to virtually everyone else in this period, they refused to give in even in the most repressive situation. And because of this, both on the black question and other issues, but they recruited a large percentage of the secondary Garveyite leadership in Harlem, basically because they were so stunned to see whites confronting the police over discrimination. They recruited leading activists in the Socialist Party, including Meta Berger, who was the widow of Victor Berger, who had been the right-wing leader of the Socialist Party. Intellectuals like John Dos Passos, who organized the intellectuals who went down to Harlem County. He was interviewed and asked why he didn't join the Socialist Party, and he said that would be like drinking near beer. They recruited a lot of the most interesting wobbly leadership. I mean, it wasn't just Big Bill Haywood, who was stuck in Moscow. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. They had people pretty much everywhere. The head of the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, during the late 30s up until 1940, was Edmund Smith, who was a secret communist. The chief counsel for the NLRB, Nathan Witt, was a communist. They had the editor of the CIO publications, Linda Coe, the chief lawyer for whatever. So they had people placed all over the place, and I'm trying to describe partly the breadth of the influence and impact that they had, which Cannon thinks that they completely squandered. So in Steele, which I've just finished spending a long time studying and writing up on the Steele organizing campaign, while the story is that Lewis wanted to organize Steele because of its impact on the coal miners' union, Lewis had a lot of money, and he had a lot of manpower, none of whom had any contacts in the steel communities. The CP throughout the 20s, and also they were among the leadership of the struggle in the AFL union, the Amalgamated, had unemployed organizations, ethnic organizations, and steel workers committees in every steel town, virtually every steel town, but certainly every major steel town in the country. And in spite of their position for setting up a left-wing revolutionary union, they still had people working between 1931 and 1933 within the Amalgamated, carrying out a struggle culminating in 34 and 35 to transform the Amalgamated. They were sectarian. They could have possibly done more in the amalgamated, but they still worked within the amalgamated during this period, which is somewhat strange given their position about only setting up a revolutionary union. So the question is, I mean, the question that Cannon raises is the degree to which they squandered all this support and goodwill. By 1936, they opposed the large sentiment, even in AFL unions, for a Labor Party and to refuse to support the Democrats, and they were among the biggest campaigners in 36 for a Labor Party. But their activity in terms of agitating and pushing on issues of equality for African Americans continues even through in the late 40s, which in some sense is hard to explain given the degeneration and the Stalinization of the party. So I had a correspondence with Jim Robertson about what they were doing in the 1940s and why this continued, given that, you know, we date Stalinization from 1928. And he said that even with his experience in Oakland, that the major issue that the party fractions were pushing on and after World War II was black unemployment and equal access to jobs and whatnot. So, all right, so where does this come from? And here's, I at one point was an adherent of the black nation thesis, at least for a while, and it seems to me one telling point about its inadequacy is certainly Harry Haywood says, if you believe that black agricultural worker, that the black belt will be destroyed by the development of capitalism, then you don't understand how imperialism works. But in fact, that's exactly what happened as blacks were drawn to the cities and the majority of the black population ended up in the north in large urban areas, many of people as industrial workers. But the strength of the Black Belt thesis seemed to me, it focused attention on the South. It said that the fight for freedom and equality for African Americans was a central part of revolutionary strategy. And it pinpointed the horrors of slavery and sharecropping. And for people who have, there are a number of new books on slavery. One that I've used in my courses is this book, The Half Has Never Been Told, which I think has a lot of flaws, but by Edward Baptiste. But the reason I've used it is that if there's any question about how horrible slavery was and this stuff about there were all these benign things, this book will erase all that for you. I mean, he argues that it became worse and worse in the 1830s and the 1840s as the demand for cotton worldwide and the violence against slaves and whatnot. But the Negro Nation thesis itself, I would argue, figured very little into the work of the CP. If you look through the party organizer, there's continual critiques, both in the North and the South, why the comrades did not put forward this view. But what I would argue that it did, first of all, it forced them on an abstract level to send lots of leading cadre into the industrial areas of the South and also, I think somewhat tragically, into the rural areas. And rural workers, particularly in capitalist country, have very little leverage, and if there's violence that goes on, they're just going to be smashed and killed. And this is what happened to a lot of people in the sharecroppers organization. On the other hand, Birmingham, which was the industrial center of the South, Robin Kelly estimates that by the late 1930s, they had over 1,000 members, most of them African American, of the CP in the Birmingham area. They were leading activists in coal, which was an industry in Alabama that was half black and half white, 25,000 coal miners. They were leading activists in steel, which in 1933, which was probably 80% African American, and in the metal mining area, which was about, had about 10,000 workers. Alabama became the most unionized state in the South. In 1946, 25-26% of workers were organized. If you look, compare that today, which is maybe unfair, the only state with 26% workers organized is New York State, and that's based on the huge number of public sector workers who were pretty much 100% organized in the state at both the local and state level. And they did similar things in Atlanta, Memphis, St. Louis, et cetera. So this pushing in terms of the black question continued in a very strong way after the Sixth Congress and through pretty much all periods until the Hitler-Stalin Pact until the end of the Popular Front period. They dropped, first of all, the line on the black nation for a while, and they also lessened up on pushing the issue as strongly. They lost cadres and lost membership in Harlem when they became less aggressive, and the same thing happened during World War II. In some sense, their commitment to the black nation thesis was a signpost for their aggressiveness on fighting for freedom and equality for African Americans. So I mention these things because Jacob's book ends in 1928, and so for many people who look to Stalinization, that's the end of the story. And that the CP and the Comintern are bankrupt in every respect after that. It seems to me there's lots to learn from the things that the CP did, particularly around the black question, in the whole 1930s and even the stuff that Jim wrote me about in 1948 and 1949 that they were doing in Oakland, things that one should look to in some other context beside the context that the CP was in. So I'm going to stop there. And hopefully I've said some things that might provoke people to listen.
I should say so.
Okay. I want to thank Jacob and the organizers of the conference for asking me to be here. I haven't talked about Jacob's book before, so I will start by extolling some of his virtues. It's the very title, The Communist International and U.S. Communism, 1919 to 1929, pretty much stakes out a ground historiographically that Jacob's going to cover. That clearly is going back to Draper. And I think in this room, as I look around, a lot of people here will have a mixed relationship with Draper, but one that actually recognizes the positive contribution. I mean, when Mike said he gets a lot of things wrong, Draper, I think he gets one major thing wrong. But what he does is get a lot of things right. And a lot of the New Left scholarship is far less likely to get the details right. I mean, if you're actually checking footnotes in Paul Buell's books, you will find a lot of errors and mistakes and puzzles. And Draper's, I can tell you, if you go to Draper's work, it will at least be right on the basics, and I think you would confirm that, far more so than the New Left scholarship. And both Draper and Zumoff are therefore incredibly useful, also because of the range of their studies. I mean, what Jacob is saying in the introduction to his book is that some of the, what he calls the specialized studies of the CP have been in some sense narrower, more specialized, more focused. A lot of the New Left work, I mean, it's understandable and it has strengths. They had a social history orientation that allowed them to get into particularity. But also, you know, if you've done a lot of this work over time, you do recognize that one more community study is not going to tell us the answers. Eventually, you do need, actually, to work in a synthetic kind of manner, which is how Draper started. And it's what Jacob is returning to with a lot of new sources, particularly Comintern available material. So it's stepping outside of the particularities of individuals and locales to present the kind of overview necessary to appreciate the reciprocal relations of American communism and the Communist International, which is also fundamental. And that was the big question that Draper, you know, got wrong, which is that he... And I think he had it more right as he was writing earlier than he did later. And then he was even more right when he was writing those two volumes than when he got into the venomous sort of reciprocal relationship of Draper versus the New Left and the New Left historians versus Draper. This brought out the worst in Draper. It brought out the Cold War warrior in him. So that 1980s material is actually far worse than what he was writing in the 50s, Ironically, the distance of the Cold War didn't actually improve Draper. It seemed to make it worse. And the strength of Jacob's approach then, like Draper, is that he covers a great deal of ground. He does not lose sight of what was happening in the United States, but as well, he knows what's going on in Moscow and around the world, and he's constantly bouncing these things off, which is, of course, entirely how one needs to approach the whole process of the formation of a revolutionary organization in the 20s, not only in the United States, but everywhere. It's a reciprocity of international developments and national experiences. And so this is not a study that really gets bogged down in detail, and it generally captures, however, the essence of a series of important developments in which communists charted new approaches to politics. And there's very good discussion of the Farmer Labor Party. African Americans, where Jacob very much follows Draper's structure. I mean, the last four chapters are about the black question in the same way that Draper, this is a mundane point, ends his books really with the discussion of the black question too. And of course, the trade unions. There's a very rich, I think, account of the foreign language federations and their importance in the origins of American communism, as well as a nuanced appreciation of the mid-1920s push to Bolshevization, which was simultaneously both, I think, necessary as a corrective in order to build and struggle to build disciplined parties, but also given that it was paralleled by emerging Stalinization, of course, aired in its heavy-handed centralization of power and articulation of the program of Stalinization and the subordination of struggles both internationally and also the struggle within the Soviet Union to the sort of consolidation of these leadership caste. So it's obviously Jacob's book is a very important book, and I think it allows us back into meaningful political discussions of why this is important, whereas so much of the New Left scholarship bogs down in an art for art's sake, a telling of the stories for the telling of the stories' sakes. Inevitably, when you're dealing with a lot of the New Left historians, like Randy Storch, who's written this book on Chicago, I mean, you cannot get her outside of the fact that she interviewed some people who she really loves. I love talking to those people. It means you also can't, in some senses, it's condescending towards those people and what their politics were, because our attractions to them, for all the reasons that Mike talked about, there needs to be a recognition of the heroic struggles that people engaged in. But, we sacrifice a great deal if we sort of reify those heroic struggles and don't actually engage with the political content. I mean, and to the extent that they were within the Communist Party, there were problems by the 30s that were very obvious in terms of, where they were going and why. Now, what might I say about Jacob's book that's a bit more critical? And here I'm not so much raising, I think, hard-hitting critiques as stressing maybe some druthers. What might I have liked to have seen more of? And because I think it's such a centrally important book politically, I would have liked to have seen a slightly different formulation of some issues is I would have liked to have seen a stronger articulation of these historiographic differences. It's there, but it's I think fairly subdued. So for instance, it isn't just that the New Left struggles are local and specific. It's that they generally follow a certain politics and interpretation. I would have liked to have seen that drawn out more. Again, it's there, but I would like to have seen it more explicit. And then there's the question of Draper. I think Draper's strengths, obviously, are ones that would be recognized by most people in this room. But, of course, the weakness was around Stalinization, which in effect was a term that he couldn't really in the end come to grips with because he could only see it as Stalin's power. And he equated that in essence with a Leninist orientation, which of course I would see it as fundamentally antithetical. So on the question of, again, in kind of pushing the sharpness of the historiographic differences, I think it would allow one into more of a discussion of Stalinization and how it happened. The Comintern influence, and I'm entirely in agreement with Jacob, was salutary and fundamentally important in the early 1920s. The Comintern pushed American communists to work on particular questions, and one of them was to address the black question. But of course, over the course of the 1920s, that changed. In the dialectics of that relationship of, international to national development with Stalinization shifted into its opposite. In a book that covers this centrally, I was hoping to find a bit more of, how that process of Stalinization worked. And there'd be lots of ways of addressing this. For instance, and again, it's an historiographic question, because there's two British historians of communism, McIlroy and Campbell, who, for instance, written on the Lenin School and the importance of the Lenin School as a kind of conduit and a process of transmission of Stalinization. That would be very interesting to see where American communists who went to the Lenin School, how they actually functioned as conduits of Stalinization. Clarence Hathaway is certainly an obvious case. And the Lenin School pops up in
and Jake. Harry Hayward, too.
Well, yes. And the Lenin School pops up in Jacob's book, but it's really as a... on page 286, I'm just making this up, you'll see that, Zach went to the Lenin School or Haywood, or that's how it comes up. But we don't get a sense, and for someone who's worked in the Moscow archives, I think this is an important area to kind of look at. Jumping back a bit, it's a very minor point, but again, it reveals this question. How does Stalinization happen? In 1924, the Comintern corrects the American Party on its farmer labor position. And Jacob and I would agree with that, that was the right decision. In 1925, the famous cable reconfiguring basically the executive leadership of the party comes down. There's barely a year separates those two cables. Jacob would argue that the first cable was absolutely right and it was part of the Comintern's salutary impact. The second cable, I think he would see as certainly a reflection of serious problems. I think there's maybe more nuance and complexity there? Because I do think, even though they were right in what they were saying in 1924 about the Farmer Labor Party, it was a different way of conveying Comintern authority to American experience than would have happened in, say, 21, 22. So there's a, in other words, there's something going on with the Synovia, you know, bureaucratization of the Comintern, et cetera, and a bit more of a transition there that, you know, I would like to see someone actually grapple with that, how Stalinism was actually made. We tend to know about it programmatically and see, you know, the 1928 the documents, et cetera, but it is a more gradual process, and I'm certainly not saying I'm not making the argument it goes back to Leninism, which it clearly doesn't. I think there's fascinating material on the early period, and again, I think he's following in Draper's footsteps there on the underground, and I think Draper had, you know, compared to a lot of the scholarship that's happened, that's developed subsequently, Draper had some very, you know, useful things to say about that underground period. But I would have liked to have seen a bit more on how that process, which Cannon was central in, of winning over various sectors of the underground to the position of legality. And I actually, you know, for someone who's worked on Cannon, I think he doesn't state clearly enough Cannon's central role in that. Biddleman, who was no factional friend of Cannon's, in his memoir has this wonderful kind of notion of Cannon working in these groups. Now, for me, that when I was looking at that material and Cannon's role in it, I had wondered what might be there in a lot more of the Comintern archives and stuff, and if there was any more there, and other figures and the role they played. I mean, because what Cannon brought together in that, you know, very early 1920s, and as he was leading into the founding of the Workers' Party, he was working with, you know, all kinds of people, the Jewish, various. He brought various groupings in the warring Jewish sections. He had some connection to the Finns, although it's a bit opaque. He was working very closely with Lovestone and others. So the whole way in which that worked, I would, you know, push for the necessity for a lot of us to be kind of looking at that, because that was a central issue. And then the way, though, that, however, as much as it was overcome, those divisions and those fragmentations and those factions, they still tended to kind of percolate, you know, through the 1920s in terms of the, you know, the factionalism, which then got sort of put on a new kind of boil with Stalinization in the mid to late 1920s. So, you know, I'm going to avoid saying much on the Black Belt Nation thesis, just except to say this to Mike, you know...
I know your position.
You know, in some senses, I've grown weary of hearing a defense of the Black Belt Nation thesis on the grounds that they really did good things, but it wasn't important. Well, if it wasn't important, why the hell did they have this ridiculous position anyway? And that relates, of course, to the Comintern and the decision that was taken and the way that, you know, hung over American communists. I mean, nobody, virtually, except for Harry Haywood, you know, believed in the Black Belt Nation thesis. And, you know, it's very difficult.
Victor Perlow.
Okay, I stand corrected. What if they'd have, you know, all the struggles that they fought could have been fought for revolutionary integration? All of the struggles. They didn't need this albatross in the Black Belt Nation. And it's entirely hypothetical, the argument that, you know, the Black Belt Nation thesis drew them into this, I think. But we do. But it does relate very much to this whole question of the Comintern, you know, that which is fundamental. So I guess in closing, you know, the project that Jacob has staked out, my hope is that it will bring us back to a political, you know, history and appreciation and sensibility of the importance of the Comintern and American communism. And by definition, springboard us into discussions of, you know, national development and particularity, of which Black question is one area, and the sort of generalized struggle for a communist international, which is, of course, still the project, but sadly is farther from view, you know, in 2015 than it was in 1925. Thank you.
Okay. I guess what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about what my goals were in the book, and then try to respond to some of the issues that have been raised, which I thought both presentations were very interesting and thought-provoking, and they obviously covered somewhat different ground, so it's hard to synthesize a reply to both. What were my goals in working out this book? I think that both Mike and Brian got on some of the aspects, and one of it, I mean, as I state in my introduction, I thought as history books, Draper's two volumes were very, very useful, very penetrating, and like Brian, when I was going through, for example, Draper's correspondence, including with Cannon, one of the things that struck me is that oftentimes because Cannon's responses have been published, but Draper's actual letters have not been published. When he goes to the microphone, it struck me that the process, the thought process and the investigative process of Draper, oftentimes he was asking questions I was asking questions that he had asked before in terms of formulating things. And I really think that Draper did, despite the political and other problems that he did have, a magnificent work. So then why did I go bother to write a book on the subject? I mean, I think one of them is a fundamental different political and historiographic interpretation, but also one of the key things was that in the interim between the 1950s, early 1960s, and today, obviously there's been a lot more historical sources, the Comintern archives being the most obvious of them, but there's also a lot of other things that were not available to Draper. For example, memoirs, correspondence that had not been available. And so hopefully that my book contributes to better understanding of what it was. Communist Party was. One of the key things that I do agree with Draper is that the history, as opposed to the New Left historians, is the view that the history of the Communist Party has to be, at bottom, a political history of the Communist Party, to take a history of a political party of people who were motivated by politics. It has to be really to deal with what were those politics and their strengths and their weaknesses. And I mentioned it, and I think, and I'm glad that Brian mentions it, that if you're going to take communists who were active, whether it be in the plants or whether it be in the South who were among sharecroppers, to take them seriously, you have to take seriously the politics that they had. Otherwise, it's dismissive and insulting. And so one of the things that I try to do is to focus on the overall political picture of the CP. And so the main issues that I try to raise, one is the relationship, as the title says, of the Communist International to the party as a whole. And Draper was correct, and I think the New Left historians was wrong, in the fact that the Comintern played a key role. But what I stress is the fact that the Comintern played, at least in the early 20s, played a very positive role in the early American Communist Party. The question, the Black question, the understanding of the fight against black oppression, which Mike spoke to, I think is the most obvious example, but the book talks about other things as well. The other one is this question of Stalinization, which both in different ways Mike and Brian spoke about. And one of the key things that I think that Draper, as neither the New Left nor Draper nor most people, historians and politicians, people who are politically active, is the basic fact that Leninism and Stalinism are fundamentally different, and that Stalinism, both on a political and an organization level, was a betrayal of Leninism. And so this question of Stalinization, I think, is crucial. But one of the things that I found when I was going through the historiography, when I was going through the writings about it, is that there's really no consensus definition of what Stalinization is. And in fact, it oftentimes appears just to be a curse word. I mean, we could all agree that the Communist Party was bad in the 1930s, 1940s, well, maybe we can't, but that, you know, a lot of people will say the Communist Party was bad because it was Stalinist, but that doesn't really mean anything on a political level, because what I realize is that a lot of what people, historians said were bad about Stalinism in many ways actually represented some of the good things about the Communist Party. And so one of the things I try to do is to come up with a definition of what Stalinization meant in the Communist Party, which on the one hand was a reflection of the political degeneration of the Soviet Union under Stalin, starting in the 1920s and then obviously culminating later on, but also in the way in which the party fundamentally changed. And it was obviously a process, which I'll talk about in a minute, but I want to just talk about the date of 1929 when the book ends, why I think actually that date is crucial, without denying the fact that afterwards the party still continued to do certain things that were very good, very useful, is that, as I traced, in 1928, and people who've read Brian's book obviously would know, in 1928, Cannon and his supporters who sympathized with the Trotskyist left opposition were expelled, and they went on to form the left opposition in the United States. And in 1929, the Lovestone opposition, which was, and I'm sure I differ with Paul on this, I found it rather, well, my favorite entry in the index is Personal Nastiness of Jay Lovestone, and I think that summarizes a lot of my views. Understates, perhaps. But after 1929, the leadership of the party had programmatically and organizationally had been Stalinist in the acceptance of this idea of Stalin's idea of socialism in one country, and also any dissidents, other be it of the right or of the left, had largely disappeared, allowing the party to eventually be more malleable. So even though people might be recruited to the Communist Party with the vision of, in their eyes, fighting for October revolutions, fighting for socialism, fighting against racial oppression, fighting for the rights of the working class, the program of the Communist Party was Stalinist. So that, in some ways, explains the contradiction of some of the things the Communist Party did in the third period, which, in the United States, given the historic backwardness and the obvious racism and the importance of racial oppression in the United States, perhaps looks more favorable to some of the work the Communist Party did in the United States as opposed to other countries, for example, in Germany, because obviously it looks better to be fighting against the Klan in the South than it does to paving the way for the road to Hitler.
A little bit, yes.
But both of those, both of those were tied up with the third period. So, I mean, in terms of trying to address some of the issues that I think that are important, I mean, again, this question of the importance of Stalinization, I want to talk. I thought it was very interesting the point that Brian brought up about the farmer labor in 1924 versus what happened in 1925 at the Comintern, at the Communist Conference. To make this a little more accessible to people who are not attuned to a yearly or a monthly development in the Communist Party. I mean, starting in the early 1920s, well, first there was this movement for a labor party in the United States that, particularly in Chicago, various trade unionists, for example, the head of the Chicago Federation of Labor, Fitzpatrick, were supporting. Part of the early American Communist Party, tied up in this ultra-left idea of anything short of immediate revolution was a betrayal, was totally ignorant, or not ignorant, but was hands-off of kind of this agitation for a labor party. And one of the things that Cannon did is he fought as part of trying to get the party to work in the trade unions, as part of taking advantage of legality, to pay attention to this movement for a labor party. But by the 1923, a lot of it had dissipated. Instead of a movement for a working class party, albeit one with a kind of a reformist leadership, it had kind of turned into this attempt to tail this predicted upsurge in agrarian radicalism, the Farmer Labor Party. And then in the lead up to the 1924 presidential election, a lot of the farmer labor support had kind of dissipated into support for the Republican Wisconsin Senator Robert La Follette, who was a major progressive figure of the day, but he was a capitalist politician. He was viciously anti-communist, and what he wanted to do was to make capitalist politics a little cleaner than the Republicans and the Democrats, or the mainstream Republicans and Democrats, because he was obviously a Republican. And so there was a lot of pressure for the Communist Party to support La Follette. And there was a lot of the leadership of the Communist Party kind of went along with this and tried to come up with formulations which might be familiar to people who are kind of familiar with some of the American left and the Democrats today to support La Follette while not officially supporting La Follette. And so there was a discussion in Moscow at American Commission, which I talk about in the book, and it's also in Brian's book, and Draper talks about it, where the Comintern came out fairly at the last minute, but said that the party had to draw a class line, not support La Follette, and they ended up running William Z. Foster, who didn't get a lot of votes, but it was a very confusing intervention on the for a lot of rank-and-file communists and leaders. But what I argue in my book is that, in fact, it was politically crucial because what it did is it forced the party to draw a very crude but hard line between support to kind of, in this case, a Republican candidate, a dissident Republican candidate, and working class politics. So that was an example, as Brian indicated, where I would say it was a positive intervention. Now, why did the Comintern intervene that way has a lot to do with what was happening in the Comintern, totally unknown to American communists, debates between Trotsky and Zinoviev and Kamenev. But in 1925, what had happened in the Communist Party convention, there had been... by that time, the Communist Party had almost split apart into mutually hostile factions, and the Comintern sent a representative, in this case Gusev, to adjudicate the factions and essentially handed political power against what most of the communists had supported to, in this case, happened to be the Ruthenberg-Lovestone faction. But I would argue that while it's useful to look at what had changed in those intervening years, and I hope I did some degree in the book, that there were in many ways fundamentally different types of interventions. The La Follette intervention was, in fact, as far as I remember, not a cable per se, as a actual discussion at an American commission in Moscow, whereas the Gusev cable was, in fact, a telegram that he got in the middle of the night that he announced it to the people, or to the delegates of the party. And I think it's important, I mean, it's the question of how the Comintern had changed between 1924 and 1925, I think is a extremely crucial one. But I also think, again, with this question of Stalinization, it was not necessary. It was not an immediately obvious one to the people in the American Communist Party, and that's part of the contradiction: is that you have this process of Stalinization without it being clear politically for the cadre in the party, much less the membership, what it meant. And so I think to some degree that explains some of the confusion of the time. And that played out, for example, as Brian mentioned, in the question of Bolshevization, which is both, as I called in my book, and I think Brian used a similar term, a two-edged sword. Obviously, one could go on and on about this, and I do for 400 pages, so I will. I wanted to briefly get back to the question of the Black Belt in my last couple, which, somewhat surprising to me, has been an issue at almost every discussion that I have brought up on this book. I mean, not just at various historical materialism conferences, although it has, but, for example, at Tamman Library a month ago, or 2 months ago, it was really one of the central disputing issues. And that kind of strikes, which surprised me. I wasn't actually expecting it, especially given the fact that, as I think we're all agreed, as an actual theory, the idea that Black people in the American South are a separate nation that should fight for independence is, at least from both a Marxist and just a sense of reality, an utterly fantastical, I guess, idea. That is to say, it has no basis in reality. One of the things I try to do in the book is explain its kind of origins, both in terms of what was happening in discussions in the Comintern, and how it reflected this process of Stalinization in both the immediate theory, but also, I argue, and I can't spell out all the details now, but its adaptation, its adoption was part of this idea of trying to force development in the United States into the Stalinist schema of two-stage revolution as well. That is to say, first you fight for bourgeois democratic reformers, and later on, the old Menshevik theory of then you fight for socialism later on. In terms of what was its effect on the American Party, well, I think that there are two issues that have to be dealt with. One is that the Comintern intervention, which had been crucial all along to get the American Communist Party to take up the Black question, in 1928-1929, it was kind of wrapped up in this Comintern, idea, or this idea that was pushed by the Stalinist Comintern, the Negro Nation theory. So in that sense, what the Communist Party did, of course, was correlated to the adaption of this theory. But as you know, a scientist will say, correlation is not causation. And the fact Comintern intervention could have come in other ways without being wrapped up in this fantastical theory. The fact that it didn't, I think, speaks to the fact of where the Comintern was at the time. And I think that what Mike speaks about of the work of the Communist Party is absolutely important and crucial to understand, and in many ways not only brave, but extremely awe-inspiring of what a lot of the Communist cadres, Black and White, did in the American South and the North, but also that has to be kept, again, in this broader context of Stalinization, because, the best of the New Left writers, I think, look at the 1930s, the Third Period and not the Popular Front. But then, of course, the Popular Front followed after. I mean, the Communist Party doesn't end, right before the 7th Congress. And so... part of this idea of Stalinization of the party is that when the 7th Congress, even before that, this idea of Popular Front, class collaboration, supporting the Democrats come, they support it. And they do, in fact, squander this, so that it's awe-inspiring that they recruited 1,000 or more black communists in Alabama. But it's also tragic that the party, you know, during World War II said the fight for the independence of the British colonies in the Caribbean and various other things had to be put on hold to support, you know, U.S. and British imperialism. So that, in some ways, is the contradiction of Stalinism. The party did not end in 1929, but programmatically, it had accepted this idea of socialism in one country. So my book, however, does end in 1929, so I want to not speak all that much about the third period, even though I think it's a very fascinating period. So I should also just mention, since briefly about historiography, that I don't pretend to really be the first person to have looked at some of these issues in this way. And so, and to conclude, I just want to, on a historiographic and also a personal level, to thank Brian and Mike and also Andrew, who was my dissertation advisor.